Is supported by the following community underwriters.
The Fierce Grizzly, a Roxbury eatery on the corner of Vega Mountain Road and Main Street, serving breakfast and lunch 6 days a week and dinner on Friday and Saturday evenings. Closed Thursdays. Reservations suggested 845-901-2351. 845-901-2351. Or thefiercegrizzly.com.
The Mountain Eagle, the community newspaper and website serving the Catskills region, covering Delaware, Schoharie, Greene, and northern Ulster counties, with local reporting, regional events, school sports, letters, and features, all in the Mountain Eagle. 1053 Main Street Gallery and Fleischmann's, designed as a space to support a vibrant and active artistic community nestled in the Catskill Mountains. 1053 Main Street Gallery presents Falling Forward, a solo exhibition of paintings by artist Gary Mayer, on view through Sunday, February 13th. Open Friday and Saturday from 11 to 5, Sunday from 12 to 4, and by appointment. Information about the gallery and upcoming exhibitions at 1053maingallery.com.
Hi, this is Audie Martello, host of the Catskills Cafe, inviting you to take a seat with me in my virtual coffee house and listen to classic folk, folk rock and bluegrass, new and traditional sounds, plus interviews with indie and established artists. Come and join me every Sunday afternoon from 2 to 4 p.m. right here on WIOX Roxbury. Community radio, live and local in New York's Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM, MTC Cable Channel 20, and WIOXradio.org.
Okay, good evening. You're listening to WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM, MTC Cable Channel 20, and on the campus at SUNY Delhi at 107.5 FM, and at WIOXradio.org, and on your mobile device at any FM radio app. This is From the Forest, where every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m., we talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John. Ryan's out tonight, but I got Zane sitting here with me from the Catskill Forest Association. Zane, how's it going?
Good, John. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. What have you been up to? What have you been seeing in the woods these last few weeks?
I was thinking of that before I got in here, but I keep coming back to this couple eagles I saw the other day going up and down the Esopus.
Oh, yeah? What were they doing?
Probably looking for some fish. Yeah. I don't know much about eagles.
Is that river getting froze up? I haven't been by there in a couple weeks.
I don't know. I've seen spots of it still flowing myself. Yeah. But, yeah.
Cool. Well, I don't know. At work, we're pruning apple trees. This tis the season. The days where it's cold and miserable are the days to be out there pruning your apple trees. So yeah. Maybe we'll have a show on that one of these days. Who knows? But we have some archived. What else have I been doing? I've been trying to stay inside at my house. Been working in the wood shop a lot. I've got a couple projects going on. Built myself a nice coffee table.
Nice.
Yeah. So
what out of what?
Black cherry. Huh? Big piece of black cherry crotch. Came out of a farmer's pasture in Hamden area. Hmm. Yeah, I milled it up with my chainsaw mill like a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago. I forget, but it's been sitting around and finally did something with a big chunk of it.
Neat.
So, yeah, no, I've been having fun doing that. But, well, tonight's going to be a good one. We're talking moose in New York with Cornell's Jen Grauer. Jen is a graduate student at Cornell's Department of Natural Resources and Environment, Cornell Wildlife Health Lab, studying parasitic threats to moose in New York's Adirondack Park, working to quantify juvenile moose survival, the impact of parasites on moose health, and community dynamics of these parasites and their multiple hosts, broadly interested in both community and population ecology, and the role that parasites play in influencing vertebrate populations. Jen completed her master's in wildlife ecology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and her undergraduate studies at University of Vermont. So let's see if we can get her on the line. Jen, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
All right, great, because I haven't taken a phone call in a little while, so I was unsure if that was going to happen. I got it figured out. So tell us, where are you calling from?
Oh, so right now I'm in the Ithaca area at home. I moved here about this time last year in January and started the research project then. So I've been a New Yorker for about a year now.
Oh, great. Where'd you come from?
I came last from Nebraska, where I was working as a wildlife biologist for the state agency there. But originally I'm from Maryland, so still an East Coaster.
Okay, cool. So I'd ask you, what's the weather in Ithaca, and how's it compared to Nebraska?
Well, we've had a good bit of snow, and my fiance keeps telling me that it's definitely colder than Nebraska. And, you know, having lived in Vermont and Wisconsin and some northern places, I've definitely gotten used to the snow and cold weather. So this hasn't been too bad, and it seems like a milder winter this year, but definitely gets chilly.
You know, I always thought that North Dakota, Nebraska, that area, it's got to be cold in the wintertime, no?
Yeah, oh my gosh, and so windy. So usually you just get really cold breezes and pretty extreme weather. So like really cold winter and really cold summer, but often it ends up being dry enough that it doesn't quite feel like a chill that gets all the way to your bone.
Yeah, when I lived in Saranac Lake, the local news station was so proud to announce the days, and this happened many days of the year, that Saranac Lake was the coldest city in the lower 48. So I could never believe it, though. I always thought that somewhere else has to be colder. But anyway, I digress. So tell us about your research. What's going on with moose research in New York State?
Sure. So there's been a pretty long history of moose research in the state, and I'm just kind of tacking on to the most recent efforts to figure out what's going on with moose. Since they've recolonized the state in about the 1980s, they've been growing, but in recent years, the population has kind of stabilized, and we don't really know why. So first, you know, there are big efforts to kind of quantify how the population is really doing, get some numbers behind that beyond just population estimates. And then also to specifically look at parasites as a potential mechanism that could be limiting the population here.
Okay.
In the past, there's been a lot of collaring efforts and aerial surveys that have shown that adults are actually surviving pretty well, and they're reproducing a lot. So we don't really know if the same can be said about juvenile moose and calves, so whether they're surviving and growing into an adult and, you know, what role parasites might be playing in juvenile moose survival.
You said that the moose population is kind of stabilized in the last few years. Does that mean that moose populations in the past were higher, and they have kind of, after they've colonized, they might have hit maybe like a carrying capacity or something like that?
Yeah, that's definitely something that we're looking at and we think could be going on. We definitely had higher populations of moose before they were extirpated from, you know, habitat loss and over-harvesting. And once they've come back in the last 40-so years, they've been growing as a population, but we haven't seen a lot of those, like, cyclical dynamics of kind of overshooting a carrying capacity, undershooting it, and then stabilizing. It just kind of seems to have trailed off and hasn't been growing as much as expected.
Okay, so if you saw that a carrying capacity was met, you'd see a big drop and decline first.
It seems like it. We'd see some leveling off of that population, and actually some of our collaborators at the Department of Environmental Conservation have just come out with research about carrying capacity and what they think the nutritional content and availability is like in the Adirondacks, and it actually seems to match pretty closely what we are seeing for population estimates in the Adirondacks, about 700 or so to 800 or so individuals. So we might be seeing some of that, but we're also not really understanding what might be impacting juveniles and why we're not seeing recruitment to the population of these younger age classes.
Interesting. So you mentioned 700 to 800 individuals estimated in New York. How does that compare to other states? I know Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine all have moose as well, right?
Yeah, that's correct. And our population is pretty low in comparison to them. Actually, in Maine, they have, like, the highest number of moose in the lower 48, you know, second to Alaska. So they have a lot and really high densities of moose, but we're pretty low on that spectrum. And actually, there's also some moose in Connecticut and Massachusetts, but those numbers are really low, too, just a couple hundred of individuals.
Wow, Connecticut, huh?
Yep. I think just on, like, the northwestern side of the state.
Wow. That's something I wouldn't have predicted. All right. Well, so what is this? Who's this research with? I mean, you're in collaboration with a few others, right?
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of collaborators on the project, a lot of interested parties. And like I said, they've been doing this research for way longer than I've been here. So the work is funded by the Department of Environmental Conservation, NYSDEC. And I work with Angela Fuller at Cornell, who's also through the USGS with the New York Cooperative Fish and Wildlife Research Unit, as well as Kristen Schuler, who's the co-leader of the Wildlife Health Lab, and Jackie Frere, who's at SUNY ESF. And they've also worked in the past with agencies like the Nature Conservancy and Wildlife Conservation Society.
Okay. Well, so I guess let's kick it off with, I mean, I'm sure people are wondering, what does a moose need to survive? Maybe some people didn't even know moose were in New York State. So where are they? And we're sitting here in Delaware County in the Catskill region. So I guess answer those.
Yeah, those are great questions. I've definitely encountered a lot of people who didn't know that we had moose here. And for the most part, they are centralized in the Adirondacks, especially the, like, northern and northwestern portions. And that's where we get those population estimates from, is just from surveys conducted within the Adirondack Park. But they definitely go, you know, outside of that. They don't really care about our boundary lines. And the DEC will get sighting information from, you know, east of the Hudson River fairly frequently. And also, like, I think there were 16 or so sightings in the Catskills in the last 3 years. So it happens less often, but they definitely are still around. And a lot of what they need in the state is based on forest structure and species composition. So some of the species they really prefer are things like red maple, a lot of the birch species, And then that's pretty typical of what they eat in the summer. But in the winter, when that's less available, they'll shift to less desirable things just based on what's available, like balsam fir. So they tend to avoid those things when the more palatable species are around. And they also avoid things like beech. But it seems like there is a good amount of nutrient available to them as far as forage species in the Adirondacks. And most often they can just get limited by amounts of forage and then things like crude protein that would be available.
All right. So you're saying mostly birch species and red maple. Is that what kind of forest are we looking at where they're eating those? I mean, I assume that's young growth?
Yeah, definitely. That seems to be one of the most important things of where we find the moose and where they occur in like higher densities. So I was surprised by this at first, but they really do take to areas that have been cut for timber harvest or management and really prefer the regeneration of those stands after about 4 to 7 years. That seems like kind of a peak height and quality of regeneration that they go after.
And that's mostly wintertime habitat, or are they on something else in the summer?
Usually they'll be there in the summer when there's leaf out and they can go after things like new vegetation growth, and then go after things like aquatic vegetation as well. But then in the winter, they kind of hunker down based on where they can keep a little more warm and then just where some conifers might also be available.
Interesting.
Well, personally, I've never seen a moose myself. It's probably a lot of our listeners haven't seen a moose either. But I have seen a lot of deer. How do moose and deer differ? I mean, moose seem to be better adapted at kind of colder climates, kind of a winter landscape. What about their biology makes them better adapted?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's definitely been my understanding, too, is that moose are really well adapted to these colder climates. Some of that is body shape and size, just the arrangement of their toes and digits that give them the ability to walk through a lot of snow in the winter. Long legs let them do that a little better. The length of their hair and ability to thermoregulate is really important for them in winter. And then it also means that they're kind of limited on their southward range because they don't like when it gets really hot in the summer.
So it
seems like the deer have been kind of shifting more and more northwards lately just because of warming climate and milder winter conditions.
Yeah, it seems like what allows them to survive and thrive in colder climates causes them to struggle in kind of warmer climates.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
and that also has a lot of implications for them getting a lot of these parasites because some of these external and internal parasites actually have evolved with deer, with white-tailed deer. And so more overlap between deer and moose can also mean more transmission of these parasites. So that's a whole other thing that they have to contend with in addition to temperature changes.
Interesting. Yeah, I wanted to get into parasites a lot soon because I think that's mostly what you're studying now. But one last thing on ecology. We talk a lot on this show about, this is a very, very common subject here in New York State is the deer story, right? How that impacts forest regeneration, forest ecology. Are moose in that picture at all throughout their range? How do moose change the forest throughout the Northeast?
Yeah, moose are, definitely really important in shaping forest structure and species composition. Since, they just eat so much forage on a daily basis, I think in a year they can consume like 5 to 6 tons of dried plant matter. So they, directly influence the forest through taking species, which can in turn influence things like the properties of soil and then have a cycle on continuing to influence forest structure that way. And as far as, like, issues that might cause, at least here where we have such low densities, we haven't really heard it being a problem. But when moose can get to really high densities, sometimes they can regulate their own populations by foraging that much. And they also have conflicts with a lot of timber companies when they, you know, select for these regenerating stands.
Okay. Yeah, so similar to deer, right? I mean, a regeneration cut, a clear cut, or a seed tree could fail with the presence of an intense herbivore population.
Yep, definitely.
Hmm. All right. Well, so I guess let's get into it. Let's talk about your project overview. You know, what are other states experiencing that we are or aren't, or let's begin on what you're doing right now.
Sure. A lot of it has stemmed recently from what we've been seeing in neighboring states, where, you know, states like Maine with high densities of moose are having outbreaks of winter ticks. It's one of the external parasites that they get, and that can have direct influences on juvenile moose and, to a lesser extent, adult survival. In Maine, they've had individual moose with, you know, tens of thousands of winter ticks on a single moose. So when they're affecting them over the winter, that can mean a lot of blood loss, a lot of thermal constraints, and just physiological constraints for a moose that can end up leading to them dying.
Yeah, that's really crazy to think about. I mean, I have a friend up in Maine. He's been on the show a couple times comparing New York forest to Maine forest, and he's talked about winter ticks and moose, where it's not uncommon for a moose to have 30 to 40,000 ticks on them. That is unheard of to think about. I couldn't even imagine that, but to the point where he sees moose beds in the snow and there's blood in the beds from the ticks. So that's mostly, what's the mortality cause in that? Is it mostly just the inability to perform other life functions like feeding and thermoregulate, or is it actual blood loss that causes death in that moose?
Yeah, it's kind of a combination of all of those things, especially with a calf that's smaller and more of that blood loss has more of an effect on the whole creature. There's that impact, but it's also at a really bad time of the year where moose are already nutritionally limited. In the, like, late winter, early spring is where we see them most often dying from this. They also will try and groom the ticks off and have a harder time of it than other herbivores like elk or deer. So they end up losing hair, and that can also leave these big patches of hair loss on moose. Sometimes they call them ghost moose because they look really white because they're lacking that dark hair in spots. And this just makes them, you know, more susceptible to those winter temperatures, less able to thermoregulate, and kind of all these compounding effects on their body.
So this grooming you're talking about, it's sort of the moose feels these ticks all over its body, and it looks for trees to kind of rub itself on, and through that it kind of rubs off some of its winter coat.
Yep, yeah, that's correct. It can either, you know, break the hair at certain points or just rub patches entirely raw down to the skin.
Mm. Wow. Are these winter ticks a factor in New York State?
Yeah, we've definitely seen them here on all of the moose that have been captured and then ones that we opportunistically get that have died. But we don't think they're as big of an issue here as they are in Maine or Vermont or New Hampshire. And that's probably because we just don't have the numbers and the densities of moose that those states do. The winter ticks really seem to take off when moose are densely populated, and they can kind of hop from moose to moose and over years accumulate in these high density areas. So we think to a lesser extent they could be playing a part in moose health, but we actually think a bigger source of mortality for calves here could be internal parasites, and those would be things like brain worm or giant liver fluke.
All right, well, let's get into that then. What is a giant liver fluke and a brain worm?
Yeah, so these are basically worms that normally use white-tailed deer as hosts, and so they complete their life cycles of developing in the host and then laying eggs and being passed through the feces of a deer. To a lesser extent, they infect moose, and that's usually inadvertent when a moose will either take up vegetation or things like snails and slugs that are also secondary hosts for those parasites. So that's kind of an overview of the life cycle, but when they do get taken up by moose, since they're not as well adapted to being in those hosts and they can't complete their life cycles in moose, so they can't pass through the body and release their eggs, they can cause a lot of damage. So those are like the diseases that we end up seeing.
Yeah, so these internal parasites, like the brain worms or the liver fluke, what kind of damage do they cause inside the moose, and what are the symptoms of that people might see?
Yeah, good questions. The liver fluke, as you might guess, usually spend a lot of time in the liver, and they can kind of get lost in a moose and cause a lot of damage as they migrate through the body. When they do get to the liver, they'll cause a lot of tissue damage, a lot of loss of liver function, and they can cause issues in other organs as well. So different challenges to just the body function of a moose. With the brain worm, they usually migrate to the brain to complete their life cycle. But in moose, they can cause a lot of neurological issues. So they can actually make it harder for a moose to take care of themselves. If you've ever seen any videos of a moose kind of stumbling around and not being able to walk well, that's one of the side effects. And this can make it more likely for them to be hit by a vehicle.
Okay. And what else are other factors other than, you know, these parasites and maybe winter ticks and some of this habitat that you're talking about? Is there anything else you're looking at or is a significant factor in population loss?
Yeah, a lot of the big things here are things like the nutritional limitation, things like parasites and the effects on moose health. We don't really have to contend with predators like we do in some other areas of the U.S., like Minnesota or Alaska. So a lot of it can end up being these bottom-up controls of plants and nutrition or thermal constraints, and then also kind of parasites taking the place of predators.
Okay. You mentioned the deer are the primary host of the brain worm, and this doesn't affect deer very much. You said because they get it all the time.
Yeah, it actually seems like deer don't really face a lot of the negative consequences of those parasite infections. The parasites are used to navigating inside of a deer and can release their eggs and go about their business without really affecting the deer that much.
Interesting. Well, this is From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic. Tonight, we have moose in New York with Cornell's Jen Grauer. We're going to take a quick break, and when we get back, I want to talk more about moose and forest quality, and specifically in the Adirondacks of New York State.
I'm gonna catch tomorrow now.
You're gonna wanna hold me just like I always told you. You're gonna miss me when I'm gone.
Nobody here will ever find me, but I will always be around. Just like
just like the songs I leave behind me. I'm gonna live forever now. You fathers and you mothers, be good to one another. Please try to raise your children right. Don't let the darkness take them. Don't make them feel forsaken. Just lead them safely to the light. When this old world is blown asunder and all the stars fall from the sky, remember someone really loves you. We'll live forever, you and I. I'm gonna live forever. I'm gonna cross that river. I'm gonna catch tomorrow now. I'm gonna live forever. I'm gonna cross that river. I'm gonna catch tomorrow now. I'm gonna cross that river. I'm gonna catch tomorrow now.
All right, that was Live Forever by the Highwaymen. This is From the Forest, and we're talking Moose in New York. We want Moose to live forever in New York State. This is Moose in New York with Cornell's Jen Grauer. Jen, you still there?
Yep, still here.
All right. So I want to dive deeper on exact habitat of moose. Let's paint a picture here. So, you know, you mentioned that 4 to 6 year old or 4 to 7 year old clear cuts are often the best feeding habitat, but you know, I mean, what do moose live in? Like, what do they need specifically other than that type of food source? Or is that all they need? Do they need endless habitat of young growth?
Well, the food is definitely important, and it does seem like a lot of managers in the Northeast feel that, you know, the differences between our forests here and forests in Maine explain a lot of those differences in population density. But they do also need things like water for regulation in summer. Like I mentioned, that summer heat can be a big factor in what areas they're able to occupy. So they do need some of that wet area to escape to and also have aquatic vegetation as a source of food.
They like to go swimming.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I know. We get some phone calls in July and August of black bear sightings either in ponds or swimming pools, and that's all they're doing too. But
trying to cool down.
Got to cool down. But yeah, I could see that. But, you know, the Adirondacks has no shortage of lakes. So, that, I mean, that can't be a limiting factor for our region, right?
Yeah, it doesn't necessarily seem like it. It seems like they have plenty of access to that when they need it.
Yeah, the Catskills are a little different. I mean, we have a lot of streams. Yeah, I don't know. So what else? So other than the feeding sign, I remember going for a hike. One of my roommates in college was a 46er, right, peak bagger, trying to get all 46 high peaks of the Adirondacks. And when he couldn't, he knew I could read a compass. He couldn't. So all those trailless peaks where he needed to actually orienteer a little bit, he'd invite me along, and if I was available, I'd go. So we did a big mountain hike once, overnight stay, and I remember hiking, bushwhacking through this balsam stand. I could not believe the amount of moose scat. There was about a 6 mile hike in before we turned off up this ridge on a trail to head up on this mountain. And there was, it was a, you know, pretty remote region, and we're following a moose. I knew we were going to just see it at some point, but we never did. But it was on top of all the other hikers' tracks. There's moose scat everywhere in the woods. And That had nothing like you're talking about. That's in the preserve area of the Adirondacks. There was definitely no cutting going on. I never saw any recent disturbance. So maybe why was that moose in that area? That would have been in probably September time frame, maybe October.
Yeah, it seems like they do definitely use that balsam fir a lot. So maybe second to a lot of the deciduous growth, they'll go after things like that. And, you know, just like they need some more shelter in summer from the heat, in the fall and winter, they'd need that similar shelter from super cold environments. But also at that time of the year, that can be rut and mating time, and so moose are moving around a lot looking to, you know, start mating and create more little moose on the landscape.
Well, that's true. Yeah, I didn't think of that. September's the rut, right? So he was
pretty much September and October.
It was probably using the hiking trail to get around to the next patch of moose.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. They'll use trails and areas that are easier to navigate, just like we enjoy.
All right, so what is not moose habitat? I'm kind of thinking back to deer. You know, deer love edges. They love recent abandonment. They love disturbance. They love growth. That's why, I mean, in Ithaca, where you're sitting, is got a big deer problem right there. Urban sprawl is a good thing for deer. What's not good for deer, where you see the lowest population densities, is some of this forest preserve land that hasn't been touched in 100 years or so. And it's they set it and forget it, let it grow big and old, which is great, but not great for deer. What is not good for moose?
Yeah, we do see some similarities to that about the forest preserves that don't have much turnover. And the little bit that we know from moose preferences in New York are from the previous collaring data that we have, where a student on a project was actually kind of backtracking where moose had been to look at what they were eating and what kind of habitats they were using. And he found that moose, for the most part, were avoiding areas with a lot of beech. It seems like there's an abundance of beech, especially understory in the Adirondack, and they also really avoid areas with spruce. So those, at least for forage availability, were things that the moose didn't really take advantage of in any season.
Yeah, I could see that. That makes sense. Well, Zane, you got anything else on habitat?
Habitat? No, nothing occurs to me. The only thing I think about around here is that I would imagine moose, when it wants to cool down, it wants to be submerged. You know, moose can be anywhere between, 5 or 6 feet tall, maybe 7 feet. It'd want to find a place that has enough depth for it to actually submerge itself and cool down. Streams around Catskills might not offer that in some locations. I don't know if that's
a factor. Yeah, that definitely makes sense.
Good theory. All right, well, Jen, I want to get into your project specifically, so let's get right into the meat of it. You said a little bit about the objectives, right? You're looking at juvenile survival, specifically as it relates to parasites, but in your words, you know, what's your project? And then I want to get into methods and what you're doing.
Yeah, that sounds great. Well, that was definitely a good summary, but really we're, you know, looking at to try and assess the health condition of moose calves, as well as indication of those parasitic infections and disease, and overall seeing what kind of factors we can see that might be limiting the moose population. So we do have information on adult survival and reproduction, but we don't really know what actually population growth rate looks like right now or how well juveniles are doing. So we want to assess survival rate for them, and we're doing that with capturing and collaring moose to monitor them for about 2.5 years after capture to keep track of their body condition when we collect biological samples at the capture. And then if they do die over the course of that monitoring, we'll go back and collect them again and try and figure out what actually caused them to die.
Okay.
So that's one part. And then we're also keeping track of these different infections as we can without actually resampling the moose that are on the landscape. So we've got a lot of trail cameras out that we're looking to keep an eye on any hair loss that could be induced by those winter tick infestations.
Okay.
And then we can also, with that, estimate what densities and abundances of white-tailed deer look like in the Adirondacks.
I would expect that a lot of the deer information is out there, right? I mean, there's a lot of hunter report, am I wrong about that?
No, you can definitely get, like, an index of abundance from some of those things, and the DEC has also conducted some aerial surveys, and those are kind of like transects from either fixed-wing airplane or helicopters that they put into models to kind of estimate an abundance. And so this method that we use would be similar as far as an index of abundance, but it would be looking at these smaller scales where we want to look at kind of like dynamics of how moose and deer are interacting. So if we see them occurring at different times on the landscape, if it changes seasonally, or if there's just certain kinds of habitats and areas in the northern Adirondacks that they just totally segregate and we're seeing them in different spots.
Okay. All right. Well, so how long has this study been going on and how long is it planned to go on for?
Yeah, so this past year we did a lot of pilot work over the summer and fall, and we set out cameras last fall, so we hope to have those out for a couple years just to give us, like I said, some of that seasonal variation in both moose and deer space use in the area. So we did our capture event this January, and we're hoping to also capture more moose the following January. And let's see, we'll do field work for another couple years. So we're also, over the summer, getting information on deer and their parasites from doing deer pellet transects. And then we're also looking at snails in some of these wetlands. So trying to get an estimate of parasites that we see on the landscape, since we can't actually get them just from moose feces or moose samples all the time.
So how do you catch a moose?
Well,
that's a big question.
It's a great question.
Big net?
Yep, big nets out of helicopters. So this year we contracted with basically a capture crew, and this company was Native Range Capture Services out of Nevada. And it's just a small crew that, you know, they've worked in the Northeast for the last 7 or 8 years on these kinds of projects. But they come out in January when it's a little easier to see and also influence where moose are going. But they'll be in their helicopters and use a net gun out in an open area to get the moose. They land their helicopter, and they'll jump out and basically wrangle this moose and, you know, pin its legs together and put a blindfold on it. And then as quickly as they can, they, you know, usually do their processing in, like, about 10 minutes or less. But they collect some biological samples for us, like feces, hair samples, and blood. And they'll put the collar on them and also take a couple of measurements and estimate body condition for us.
So this is a GPS radio collar that they have?
Yep, that's correct.
So what kind of data does that tell you other than, you know, where the moose is spending its time?
Yeah, we get a lot of movement data from it. They also have temperature sensors and accelerometers on the actual collar, so you can get activity information, and as well as, like, environmental data. And then over the course of the length of it, if the moose is in one spot and doesn't move for 6 or more hours, we actually get a mortality signal from the collar. So that's when we know to go out and check on it, see if it's died, and then collect it.
That's interesting.
Yeah, like, so if the temperature goes down to freezing and 60 mile an hour movement, you got a problem. You got someone's got that moose.
Yeah, definitely.
I don't need the net anymore.
No. Well, no, that's neat. I could imagine that is difficult to do, maybe has a low success rate. I mean, what is the success? Does the every time that helicopter goes up, can you expect to capture a moose?
Yeah, it's definitely really hard and really intense. And it seems like the biggest factor that helped was actually having DC biologists go out in advance and do some scouting. So it was really handy for them to get some locations just on GPS of where they saw moose on flight to then actually hand to the capture crew and say, you know, go after these, see if they're still there a couple of days later, and try and collar those. A lot of the success will depend on their ability to see moose, which can vary by habitat, vary by snow conditions and weather, and if they can actually get the moose into an open area where they can successfully net it and then land the helicopter. So we had really good success our first day working with them. We got 12 moose in our first day. And then the second morning that we went out, it was really a lot slower because they had to do a lot of the scouting and searching for moose instead of just going to areas of known locations. But it definitely worked out well. Everybody was really happy with that number that we got. And that was actually like a new record for the number of moose that we captured here in the state in 1 year.
Yeah, and you did it all in a day. Amazing.
Yep. Yeah, it worked out really well.
So how many do you have collars on, and how many are you looking to get collars on?
Yeah, so we were able to collar 14 total this year. We actually already had one that died. So 13 are out on the air still now. And next January, we're hoping to collar, you know, about the same number, maybe up to 16 or 17, just for the number of collars that we have available.
What was the cause of the mortality? How old was the moose? Where'd you find it?
Yeah. So this was a calf moose, and we found it actually pretty close to where it had been collared, but I was actually able to go in and observe the necropsy when they conducted it, and it seemed like, you know, there were a lot of things going on with this moose that made the capture crew rate it at a pretty low and poor body condition to begin with. So they actually told us in advance, like, you might want to monitor this one because it didn't look that great. Mm-hmm. So at the necropsy, it did look like it had pneumonia, probably aspiration pneumonia from getting food inside its lungs. It also had a lot of winter ticks on it. It had a lot of liver flukes in its liver. So we can't rule out any stress that capture might have also had with it, but it did seem like it was in really poor condition, just hardly any fat on the body at all, from, yeah, these cumulative effects of parasites and infection that it had.
Wow. So, I mean, it had all the parasites.
Yeah, it was definitely dealing with a lot.
Wow. All right. So what information, I mean, have you been able to get anything useful? I mean, that seems like very useful information right away, but what else has stuck out in, you know, in the infancy of this program already?
Yeah, well, I'm definitely excited to have moose on the air and those collars out. We'll be able to get a lot of information from that on movement, on parasites. We've started doing a lot of the analysis of the biological samples that we collected during capture. So I'm definitely excited to look at that and compare it to, like, the previous capture events that happened in New York when they were collaring adults. So we can compare it a little bit, but we also know that the suite of parasites that might be more likely to affect and have a bigger effect on juveniles might not be the same as that for adults. So we won't be able to compare it directly, but it's also going to be interesting to see any changes we've seen over time in things like winter ticks or just the spread of these diseases and the abundance that we're seeing.
Well, what's your thoughts on the research so far? I know any kind of working scientist is always thinking about the next step. Or is there methods you're looking to change in the future, or other questions you're looking to try and have answered?
Yeah, after all the excitement of the capture this January, I'll be spending the next few months gearing up for the spring and summer field work that we're going to conduct. And I briefly mentioned some of this will be with deer pellet transects to basically look at the abundance of the liver fluke and the brainworm on the landscape. And then we're also fiddling around with a couple methods to look at the snails and the slugs. So one of those I played around with last summer, and I actually collected snails from wetlands and lakes in the Adirondacks, brought them home to my basement, had them in little individual tubes, and would expose them to sunlight to see if they actually were then shedding the parasite larva. So the sunlight can often prompt that, and we did get it to work, but just in such small numbers, it was a very early trial stage. So we're thinking about trying that again this summer, and also using a different method to look at that potentially. We might be able to collect water samples from those lakes and wetlands and then look into analyzing the environmental DNA in those samples to see if we can screen them for presence of the parasites.
Yeah, I mean, that seems like it should be able to work, no? I mean, aren't a lot of water bodies being monitored that way anyway for other things, especially things that can harm humans, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that would also probably be a lot easier than me taking snails home and trying to get them to shed parasites.
Right.
It would be great, you know, if either of those methods work out, but it definitely does seem like the eDNA could be a really good way to screen a water body for the presence of those parasites, instead of just hoping that we capture the snail at the right time in the parasite cycle, if it's there.
So the eDNA survey is kind of, you're taking a sample of water and you're running it through some machine to see what life forms are there, what's most active?
Yeah, pretty close. So we take the water sample, and in the field we would basically filter all of that material onto a dry filter that we can store. And then back at the lab, we would basically extract DNA from that sample and then screen it for the genetic information that we're looking for that would be particular to the parasite species, the liver fluke in this case, and then differentiate it from anything else that might be in there.
Well, we've only got about 5 minutes left on From the Forest. We've been talking moose in New York with Cornell's Jen Grauer. Jen, I guess our final topic is, where do you see moose, the future of moose in New York State? What's your opinion and what's your hopes and beliefs?
Yeah, I'm definitely hopeful because I would, of course, like to see moose continue in the state in the future. I think, you know, it's a really charismatic species that people get really excited about, and, you know, they have a lot to contend with here. So I'm hoping that a lot of the data that we can collect can really inform their status here and help to, you know, guide management. We hope to explore some different scenarios if we find that parasites are a big impact, and then what different management decisions could mean for the population in the future. There's definitely been some work exploring the effects of climate change on moose, and that's a little less hopeful just because of the movement of deer northwards, the increasing thermal constraints that moose are going to have to contend with, and then with encroaching deer overlap, you know, that can mean direct things like more competition for work for moose, but also more exposure to a lot of these parasites. So there's definitely a lot going on, and, you know, I hope in a couple of years after we're collecting all of our data, we'll definitely have a lot more information to paint a picture of what's going on and then also what we could do about it into the future.
Is there anything to do if you find that parasites are the leading cause of the population bottleneck? What would be a possible management action?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of ideas out there as far as methods to control either the ticks or the snails, and those could be really good ideas, but are just really hard to enact on large scales. They could be really expensive and just kind of temporary as far as how long they work. But other things that we could target would be the deer population, or also even the densities of moose that we're seeing. If we see that, you know, parasites that go along with high moose densities are becoming a problem, regulation of that moose population is also an option. But we're seeing that we need to moderate the deer population to reduce those parasites, that could be a more tenable management option as well.
So you're saying there is a possibility that I could be applying for a moose tag one of these days in my lifetime?
Potentially. I it's hard to say, but it's interesting because Maine right now is actually doing an experiment with just that. They're picking a management unit and kind of dividing it in half and increasing harvest in one side of it to see if decreasing moose density has an effect on the winter tick population.
Yeah, I'm aware of that. I actually applied for a permit on that increase, that tag structure. I was unsuccessful, but I was hopeful. I wanted to be a part of that in some way. Yeah, we'll see. I mean, it makes sense. Zane and I were talking about stuff like that earlier today, right? I mean, if the carrying capacity is, you know, controlled by some type of, if it's not food, it's something else, right? If it's a parasite or a disease or anything like that, you know, reducing population could be the answer.
Yeah, there's definitely lots of population mechanisms that can regulate them going on.
All right, last question I have. Is there really big moose out there in New York State?
Is there really big moose out there?
There's no huntable population, so I got to imagine some of these bulls are getting big. No?
Oh, I would definitely think so. I mean, just that I've seen from camera photos that other folks in the area have shared with me, there's definitely some big moose out there. So, I mean, maybe in the future, I think there are people that would be happy about a moose season, but that's probably a ways off as far as where the population's at now.
Well, I'd just like to see one in New York. I mean, I came close that one day. Like I said, it was on top of all the hiker tracks right in front of us. I figured at any moment walking around a corner we'd see it, but we never did. Maybe one day. Zane, any final questions?
Cool. I hope to see one day, preferably far from the road.
Yeah. They are huge, let me tell you. It's an awe experience seeing your first moose. It's huge. But
I actually haven't seen any in New York yet alive either. So maybe by the end of the project, I'll be able to say that that's not the case.
Well, I hope you do. well, that's all the time we have here on From the Forest. Jen, thank you for coming on again. If you have any way that you want people to contact you about your research, you can give that out if you want. Otherwise, I'll leave it to you.
Okay, great. Yeah, thanks so much for having me. And my email address, if anyone has questions or wants to talk more, you can contact me at jag479@cornell.edu. That's my email there that I check often, so we'll be glad to chat.
All right. Well, thank you for coming on. We'll have to have you on again when the study's complete.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you.
Yeah, take care. All right, Zane, that's all we have time for on From the Forest. We were talking moose in New York with Cornell's Jen Grauer. Next week, I don't know what we have, but we'll get it going. And
yeah.
Good night, everyone.
Have a good night.
And the drizzle turned to snow. His eyes were red, his hopes were dead, and the wine was running low. And the old man came home from the forest. His tears fell on the sidewalk as he stumbled in the street. A dozen faces stopped to stare, but no one stopped to speak. For his castle was a hallway, and the bottle was his friend. And the old man stumbled in from the forest. Up
up a dark and dingy staircase, the old man made his way. His ragged coat around him as upon his cot he lay.